Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain, and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Well, I assume you have seen it. If you haven't, it is well worth a watch. But the National Geographic documentary David Attenborough Ocean is up there among the best of the work that he has done. And it was produced in part thanks to the good work of a man by the name of Colin Butfield. Colin is the longtime collaborator with David Attenborough, both in broadcast media and in books. And he is the founder of the production company that worked on National Geographic's David Attenborough Ocean. He's with us this morning. Colin, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
It is a total pleasure. Colin, given the longevity of both David Attenborough and David Attenborough's career, he was, of course, long established before you worked with him. Does that bring a challenge? Is it like inheriting a family heirloom or a relic? Do you have to be tremendously careful?
It's honestly, occasionally I have to pinch myself. So I watched, like probably everybody listening, I watched his shows growing up. And now, because he's such a professional, he's so used to being around film crews, you kind of forget it sometimes. And you're working away, and then all of a sudden he delivers this piece to camera that's just David Attenborough and brilliant, and you suddenly pinch yourself and you realize where you are. So yeah, it's definitely a strange experience, but obviously, you know, an incredible pleasure to be able to do it.
The pressure must be twofold though, because whatever about his significance in that sort of oeuvre, he's also based on, or the programming is based on, a capacity to get extraordinary footage. I mean, this is not set up a camera and hope.
No. He's got a reputation, rightly, for producing the best shows about the natural world that have ever been done. So whenever you do it and you work on it, you first of all have to assemble the best team. So for Ocean, we had our cinematographer, a guy called Doug Anderson, is the best in the world, I think. He's extraordinary. And you then have to really, really think about it, really plan everyone, because you know people are going to be judging it against an incredible body of work. And I hope this time, because we deliberately wanted to make it for the cinema, so we really thought about how you frame every shot to make it really work on a massive screen, we have a fresh look to it that I think is a bit different from the other things we've all done before.
How do you manage that? Because it's not like you can demand your cast perform to their direction.
No, not at all. No, it's a thing in risk management, really. You kind of think, how many days is it going to take to get this? How much money do we broadly have to do it? And how much time you spend? So a lot of it comes in the research. We spend about a year before we shoot anything, speaking to scientists, speaking to people in communities, local fishing groups, you know, anybody that knows the water in those areas, and really trying to find out the best time, the best chances we've got to capture something. And then you rely on the absolute skill of your crew and the boat crew that you work with. And more often than not, it comes off, but you definitely have those moments where you hope to get something and it just doesn't quite work. But we did very well this time.
So what were the shots that when you watched them back, you went, bingo, got it?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of, but one I want to really pull out, because I wasn't on this shoot. One of the sort of nerve-wracking things when you're not there is, well, what's going on? How good's it going to be? It's hard to judge at arm's length a little bit. And this was a place just off Hawaii called, well, about 1,000 kilometers actually off Hawaii, called Papahanaumea Kuakea. And it's this area which about 1.5 million square kilometers that have been protected. And the ocean has just incredibly bounced back to life. And when you see the footage, you actually almost can't believe what you're looking at. The sheer number of fish, the turtles, the albatross, it almost looks like this must have been faked, because surely there's nowhere left on Earth that has this much. And it really does. And so it absolutely blew me away as soon as I saw it. And I just thought, well, this is, people are going to love this.
And it has that much because it is protected from fishing?
From the worst, sort of the most industrial types of fishing. So the area, you can fish out just outside it, and actually the fishing communities are actually catching more than they used to before they protected it. So it was all set up by native Hawaiian fishermen working with the US government, and they protected it from things like bottom trawling and also actually they had things like rabbit farming on the islands, amazingly. So they protected it from things like that. And the bounce back over about 30 years is just mind blowing. So actually they are you can still fish on the outskirts of it, but they're catching more fish than before, despite having, you know, this huge recovery. So it's one of a brilliant examples of win-win around the planet. It's fantastic to look at.
What have been the species then that made you, because there are certain species revealed in your work and in more broadly where you sort of look and think, evolution can't have designed that. It is so daft. Was there anything like that you went, how does this thing survive?
Yeah, there's one. We haven't been able to film it, but we wrote about it in the book because there's been photographs taken of it. It's known as a headless chicken monster. And it's as weird as it sounds. It's a form of sea cucumber. And it looks a little bit like kind of a human heart floating in the water, or maybe a decapitated and plucked chicken, hence the name. And when it's attacked or pursued by a predator, it sort of leaves a ghost of itself behind, which is like a sort of filament of the edge of its skin that it leaves behind to distract the attacker as it sort of floats off into the distance, looking a bit like a human heart. So, I mean, it just almost can't believe it. It's worth Google it if anybody's listening, because it's worth looking at the picture. It's really quite something.
Sea cucumbers sort of have form in that area. Isn't there another one that when it's chased, it just lets all of its own guts out and says, here, eat them and legs.
That's the thing. Exactly. You can work out the theory of the evolution, but in reality, that's just quite something else. And that's the amazing thing about the ocean, is almost wherever you look, because we've not explored it to anywhere like the degree we have done on land, of course, everywhere you look, new things are found, and quite often new things are found that sort of almost defy our imagination. There was one story, if you give me a minute to say it, because it was the moment when David and I knew the book we were writing about the oceans just come out was going to work. We spoke to a deep sea scientist, a guy called Chad King, who had taken this submersible about 2,500 meters down at the seamount. And he had no idea what he was going to find there at all, even though he's an expert in this area. And he's shining his lights around. Obviously, it's pitch black down there. And he finds these things that look like sort of footballs everywhere. And he looks around, and eventually they see thousands of them, and ultimately tens of thousands of them. And they were all these octopus, all upside down, all on the ground. And octopus never hang out together. I mean, hardly ever. That's very, very strange. And they ultimately realized these were all female octopus, all giving birth. And they had found these kind of warm water seeps at the bottom of the ocean. And they were down there. It was like a giant birthing pool for tens of thousands of octopus. And you just think, this was a world expert in underwater research. He didn't even imagine this would be a possible thing to find. And so, I mean, it blew us away. And we realized, okay, we're not going to run out of stories for this book. The ocean is stranger than we could possibly imagine.
And to what extent, I mean, I know it's probably difficult to quantify, but if discoveries like that are still possible, what percentage of our oceans remain unknown? I don't mean in terms of mileage, but is there lots of that we don't understand?
Yes, almost certainly. There was an estimate by the United Nations that said there are between, I think, 2 million and 50 million undiscovered species in the ocean. And even just the uncertainty window there shows you exactly how little we know. There's about 2,000 new marine species sort of categorized each year. And that, bear in mind that how little of actually deep sea exploration we're really doing in comparison to how much we look on land. So there are millions and millions and millions of species we've never found in the ocean yet.
On the grounds that none of them will be listening, which are your favourites and which are your least favourites?
Oh, excellent question. Okay. Well, my favourite's got to be the manta ray. Particularly the oceanic manta ray. So obviously most people can picture a ray. A manta ray is absolutely massive. It's sort of, they call it wingspan, and not really wings, but its span is can be up to 5 meters. They're filter feeders, so they only eat plankton, and they eat by doing this sort of barrel roll where they literally do somersaults after somersaults. And they're just the most graceful, beautiful things to watch. And they're one of the most, it's thought to be the most intelligent fish in the sea. So they're really smart and they're really interesting behavior. So manta ray is definitely number one. My worst, it's a thing called a weaver fish. And it definitely lives in the sand in a lot of England. And if you tread on it, it absolutely really hurts. And my local beach where I go surfing and things, they're very present, and they're really, really, really hurt. And so the pain goes away in about an hour, but it's not a fun experience.
This is what, dorsal spines or something, is it that impales
you? Exactly that. That's exactly it. Apparently, the only cure is vinegar or warm water. So that's the only thing to do.
How do you feel about sea otters?
Oh, I love sea otters very much. I've had the pleasure of seeing one once. I love sea otters.
No, you're wrong, Colin. The sea otter is a horrible, horrible little fella. He looks cute. What sea otters do when they're allowed to free reign to indulge themselves, they are just terrible, terrible people.
You sound like you've had an experience here.
I've done some reading around the proclivities of sea otters, and I haven't fully recovered from the experience yet. You mentioned the book. There's a couple of books. There is the one which is already out, Earthshot, How to Save Our Planet, which is best-selling, and congratulations on that. And there is the one that you were referring to, Ocean, How to Save Earth's Last Wilderness. You're going to be talking about that at the International Literature Festival in Dublin. That's on in Merrion Square Park. It runs until Sunday, the 25th of May. So if you have any interest in going to see the event or to hear from Colin, it's ILFD or ILFDublin.com, I should say. Now, in respect of our shot at that title, How to Save the Earth's Last Wilderness, does what you were describing off the coast of Hawaii give you solace that it might be possible?
Yeah, it does. And actually way more so than really even hopes for things on land. I think one of the incredible things about the ocean is it recovers so much faster than, or at least everywhere apart from the deep ocean, recovers so much faster than life on land. So if you imagine, if you took like a regular field that's been farmed for a couple of hundred years, plowed all the time, and you left it, it will probably take 50, 80 years before it starts to look like a woodland, maybe 150 before it looked like a native woodland. You leave the same sort of area off the coast of California or Scotland or wherever, the bounce back in 10 years would be extraordinary, because kelp forests will grow so fast, seagrass will grow so fast. So yes, I think if we protected, you know, relatively modest amount, maybe that scientists estimate around a third of our coastal seas, which obviously still means the remaining two thirds can be fished and used for other things. The recovery would be absolutely extraordinary. And the good thing is we've seen it. This isn't hypothetical. Within the book, we describe sort of 8 or 9 examples of this. In the film, there's a couple we show which look spectacular. This really happens and it really works. So yeah, I'm very optimistic it could happen.
Even with the impacts created by climate change, change in currents, change in species locations, all of that can be accepted if we have a fecund enough coastal sea?
So it's a really good question. I mean, certainly all of it can be helped a lot. Whether it can be completely offset by, you know, endless climate change, I think probably the way of looking at it is it buys us a lot more time. So there's a great example where coral reefs, probably most people know, they get bleached by warming water, and that obviously climate change is really threatening coral reefs. Where fish populations have been protected and there's loads of grazing fish, the bounce back from when the reefs are bleached has been extraordinary, and they've actually survived and recovered from it. So whilst that doesn't go on limitless, it definitely suggests that if we keep, you know, fish populations healthy around those coral reefs, they'll last a lot longer than if we don't. So give us more time to do the other things we know we need to do.
Final thing before I let you go. When he's not actually filming, does he hit the bottle and the profanity?
I've definitely heard a bit of both. So no, he's kind of, you know, they say never meet your heroes. I think he's an exception to that. He's exactly what you'd hope he is. He's a absolute pro broadcasting, but he's good fun. He tells a brilliant story. He's really interested in everything. And yeah, I've had the pleasure of having a few drinks with him several times. So,
and what about the swearing? Have you heard that voice swear?
Not much, actually. I mean, I'm sure I must have done a few times, because he's definitely not puritanical. But he's not the most liberal with profanities, but he's pretty good at his impressions. He's got a cracking sense of humour as well. So he's exactly what you'd hope, I think.
There you go. On the bombshell that Sir David Attenborough is not that profane, Colin.
That's a really shocking revelation.
Really appreciate your time. Thank you very much. And I hope you enjoy the literary festival. That is Colin Butfield. Again, if you want information on the International Literature Festival in Dublin, it's ilfdublin.com. And by the way, Alexander McCall-Smith, who was with us yesterday, is going to be at that as well on the 24th of May. So ilfdublin.com if you want info. And if you missed Alexander McCall-Smith, or if you missed the totality of our chat there with Colin, you can go on newstalk.com, just search for the Anton Savage Show. Everything gets uploaded as podcast and you can listen back.
The Anton Savage Show on Newstalk.
Psoriatic arthritis symptoms can be unpredictable.
I had joint pain and I couldn't move like I used to.
I needed relief.
I got Cosentyx.
It helped me move better.
Cosentyx secukinumab is prescribed for people 2 years of age and older with active psoriatic arthritis. Don't use if you're allergic to Cosentyx. Before starting, get checked for tuberculosis. An increased risk of infections and lowered ability to fight them may occur, like tuberculosis or other serious bacterial, fungal, or viral infections. Some are fatal. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms like fevers, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, had a vaccine or plan to, or if inflammatory bowel disease symptoms develop or worsen. Serious allergic reactions and severe eczema-like skin reactions may occur. Learn more at 1-844-COSENTYX or Cosentyx.com.
Ask your rheumatologist about Cosentyx.